You now live in Georgia.
Yes.
Of course, in your book, your narrator goes with her lover from North Carolina to South Carolina, and she feels kind of bewildered. Are there a lot of subtle differences among the southern states that we don't perceive here in the north?
Yes, yes. That having to come up here, we drove to North Carolina, and it seems to me that when you pass from one state to the other, you can see why they were made separate states easily. You can just see different trees or different birds or just a different feel to the places, to me anyway.
What about the people?
Yes, definitely. I think I'm sure I have this romantic version of the people from the part of North Carolina that I'm from, but it seems to me that they're very different, especially from the people that are in Georgia. Of course, now, you know, businesses being where they are, their places are starting to blend, but I have a little thing about liking the differences, and I probably notice it more because of that. But I do think they're different.
Do you have any examples about how people may differ from one region of the South to another?
Well, the speech patterns, of course. And I can usually pick on that up on that quickly. And just the food and the pace, the way they talk about things and the things they talk about, I do think they is.
What was it like growing up in North Carolina? Guess your most formative years were the 1940s.
For me, it was a beautiful life because the climate in North Carolina, you have cold weather and you have hot weather and you have very definite seasons. And there was a feeling of the times in the 40s of a sheltered feeling that does seem to be gone from almost everywhere, where people were closer and it's a different way of life. And I'm sure that's part of the reason I wanted to write about it before it was forgotten, because things are changing so much. And the richness of the area, the crops, all the crops and the smells and the sights of the food growing in the fields and the tobacco growing, it was very rich for me.
In your novel, I don't believe you have any black characters at all. I can't recall any. Were blacks a part of your life?
Yes, they were very much. And the thing about it, they were for me in our family. We did have a big family, and we had the colored woman who worked for us as our cook, and her family and her children, and also the people that worked on the tobacco farms. Though I didn't live on a tobacco farm, I had relatives that did, and I went there in the summer and worked in the tobacco. So they blended in to the world that I grew up in so much. I was naive, I guess, about their conditions, but they were just so much a part of it that in the novel, there didn't seem to be any reason to make a big thing of it. They were just part of it. And we all loved each other. We were part of a big family at that time.
You were unaware in growing up in the 1940s of a pattern of discrimination against the blacks in the South?
That didn't come to me till much later, because I guess I was very naive. I mean, like the lady that worked for us, Lassie, and her children and her situation, I was aware of it, that they had problems, but we had problems in our home. I mean, you know, there were so many of us, there was always a catastrophe. And so it just didn't come to me until so much later. And one of the things that I did realize as I wrote the book, and I think there's a line in there about that, that the strength of black women, I think they must be the strongest people there are.
I think your lack of perception of this is not unusual, because I too grew up in Texas in the 1940s. I was used to seeing the two drinking fountains side by side in the zoo, and it was understood that blacks always used the balcony of the theaters, and they always sat in the back of the bus, and I thought this is just the way things were supposed to be. It wasn't recognized at that time, at least by us, as any kind of pattern of discrimination, and I didn't perceive it until my family had moved to the North, and the civil rights struggle began, and then I think there began an awareness in the entire nation that this so-called separate but equal didn't exist.
That certainly sounds...
When did this dawn on you that these racial patterns were not equitable?
Well, I grew up in this sheltered world, and then I married young and immediately had three babies, and my world then was staying home and taking care of those three babies. So there again, this was happening around me because this was the 50s. And my husband was from Mississippi, and we would go there, and certainly so much of the movement started there, but I still wasn't really aware of it. And by the time I became aware of anything again, which was the 60s, and I came out of the kitchen and put the diapers down, it had changed so much. And it was a real shock. And then, that's it. It was a shock to find out that these things were happening. And then I guess I was amazed that it had all been happening and I hadn't even known about it. And I'm sure I wasn't the only one that felt that way. But a lot of people.
How do Southerners perceive the North?
I'm one of the worst ones about that. Because it as a separate country. I mean, I'm sure there are many Southerners that don't feel this way. But I always thought of it as just a very separate place. And that I couldn't imagine ever having friends from the North. I didn't think we'd have anything in common. I mean, one of the first things that I was so surprised about when Mary Gordon came to Augusta and discovered me, when I heard she was coming, I thought, why should I send my old Southern story? This educated Yankee girl's not going to care anything about this story. I certainly had a shock. I've had many shocks about that. It was ridiculous for me to think that way. How could I have ever thought that way? I mean, I really must have been sheltered. I've changed so much since then, and thank goodness I've, you know, had a chance to realize how ridiculous that was.
Well, here you are in the nation's largest city, and you come from a small town in North Carolina. What sort of feelings do you have about being in New York?
Well, all of this process has been pretty amazing. When I wrote the story, I thought maybe someday somebody else might read it, or possibly I could have it published, but that certainly wasn't the reason for writing it. And all of this is a big bonus, and already I've started to have many new friends because of the work, and that's so wonderful. Of course, that's why you read, and you find friends that way, but it's absolutely amazing. I was just saying to her that when I first went into Random House and saw my little story about those people there on the desk with all these other things in this big city, it's very hard to take in.
Were you aware of a very substantial Southern tradition in literature? People like Faulkner and Wolfe and Styron and Mary Lee Settle, and I know there are others I can't remember off the top of my head.
Awfully good names.
James Dickey from Georgia.
Oh, yes. I've certainly been very aware of those people in the past 15 years since I decided that maybe I could write. And, of course, one of the first people I became aware of was Thomas Wolfe, because he was a North Carolinian. And after the children got old enough and I did start to get out, I started to study as much as I can. I felt there was such a big gap. There were so many things I wanted to know and I didn't know. And I started reading everybody. And I certainly started reading Faulkner. Can you imagine discovering Faulkner like that? And there you are. And all those people. And James Dickey lives just across the river in Columbia, South Carolina, and teaches at the University of South Carolina there. And one day I thought, I have to find some way that I can get over there and study with him. And I did. And it was a wonderful experience. Yes, I did. Mm-hmm. I started out through poetry. I never thought that I could ever write a novel. I never thought that I would possibly ever write a novel. But I'd always written little poems and then gradually big poems and learned about poetry. And I studied with Dickey.
How did you find Dickey? You weren't intimidated, were you?
I had heard him read and I didn't know what to expect because he has quite a reputation. But I thought, well, I'll take this chance. And so went over every Tuesday and every Thursday. And the surprise is what a marvelous teacher he is. It's just so different in the classroom than you'd think. I mean, a real, really good teacher. Just opened up a lot of worlds for me, listening to him.
I've had Dickey in for an interview, and he can be very dominating in many respects. It would be interesting to see him work with young people or people who are trying to write as in the role of a teacher rather than one who pontificates.
Very different personality. I mean, you know, he's such a showman. And I think that puts people off sometimes, but it didn't do that for me because, big bluff, a lot of it, I think. Very tender-hearted man.
Noticed on the dust jacket that you are part of a writer's group known as the Six. Now, what is that?
In 1967, there was an ad in the local paper that there would be a creative writing class sponsored by the Y, taught by a woman, Jean DeWitt Fitz, who had written some mystery novels. And I thought, wouldn't it be interesting if I could go to this class, because I kept having this desire to write. I didn't really know what this feeling was. I couldn't put a name to it then. I just wanted these things that I didn't know what to say about it, and kept writing my little poems secretly. That's all I'd done. So I went to the Y after a lot of fear and trembling and very nervous about it, and asked to enroll. And the woman told me that the class had already been filled, that there could only be a small number of people, and because it was the lady's home. And I guess she saw my face, because I had built myself up at that point, and I was just devastated. And she said, wait, let me call her, maybe we could take one more person. So she did call, and she did take one more person. And it certainly changed my life. And so I went there. We met in this lady's home. And
there were six of you?
There were many more than that. There were 25 people to start with. And I told her I had written some poems, and she said, well, I don't know anything about poetry, and if you can't write stories, please don't come back. And she said it in a lovely way, but so I went home and wrote a story, because I didn't want to miss out. I saw that the door was starting to open, and I didn't want to close it then, so I raced home and wrote a story. And you can imagine writing a story in a week now, but anyway, so I did. And I went back, and she said, wonderful stay. So we studied together, this group, for a few months, and then she picked people from the group that she felt had something, and she asked us to come back, and it was no longer a paid class. It was no longer a class through the Y. It was just a group of us, and we have met together every Wednesday night since then.
So what do? Exchange stories, skewer each other? And
all of those things, yes. We read aloud. And, you know, rave at each other, and then some people burst out in tears, and then they come back next week and the work's better. And we read also, we suggest things to read to each other, and we worry over the things. And this group, they are the ones that convinced me I should write a novel. And I fought. I'm too impatient. I could never write a novel. Can hardly get through this little poem. I want to see it, and then you've got it. But it was a very gradual process. But they just thought that I should write a novel. And Jean Fitz had worked here in New York. She was a Yankee. She had retired there in Augusta, and she had been an editor at one time. And she just said, you should write a novel if you have any chance of ever getting published. So I started forming the ideas for this novel, and very, very gradually got into it with them encouraging me. I'd read a little bit, and they'd say, more, you know. So.
Well, when you started your novel, what did you do? Just sit there and knock it out, or did you carefully make plans for it by using, as some novelists do, index cards and this sort of thing?
Not at all. It couldn't have been. I can't imagine if I'll do this again, and who knows, I might, but I just started. I would sit down and just let thoughts come to me and write them down, and it had no plot. It was just thoughts. Later, these thoughts were Roxana's thoughts in the book, but I didn't know where to begin. I had no way of knowing where to begin. I had studied so little, and I just thought, well, if I just keep writing these things down. But there was one particular member of the group, Tom Turner, who's with me here in New York, who he had finished a first novel, and he really thought I had something. And he would always say, don't worry about your grammar, and don't worry about how somebody else would say it. Just write what you feel. say the things that you think. Say it in your words. And so he was really, really was the one that kept on after me, and he just knew how to say the right things to keep me going. And so for I went along like that for about a year, just sort of writing down little wild thoughts. And in 1976, the college, Augusta College in Augusta, started a writers' conference called the Sand Hills Writers' Conference. And they brought the North Carolina novelist Reynolds Price there. And I was very thrilled about that because I've been reading his work and I loved his rhythms and I really felt close to his work. And I thought, oh, I'd like to meet him. And maybe I might tell him about trying to write this story. So I had just really had about one chapter, which was just a jumble. But I sent it in to him, and he read it. And when I met him, he said, "Yeah, I think you might have something. You know, you have my blessing." What could he say at that point? Here's one chapter of a novel. But it meant so much for him to say that. I mean, he was a real writer, and he was just a warm person, and he was from North Carolina, and he wrote about those same people that, you know, that I was trying to write about. So that really helped. So I knuckled down and started writing some more. But I still was working part-time at the library. And so I didn't have any scheduled writing time at that point. So I would just write when I had a chance, and it wasn't too often. But gradually the things started to come together for the novel. This old song, for one thing, which the song had never been anything in my life, really. It just, my unconscious just kept coming through with these words to this song, and I thought, well, I really ought to find out about the song. But I didn't remember about it. I couldn't find it anywhere. I would ask if I'd see folks sing, I'd ask if they'd ever heard of it, whatever. But finally a friend found a record of it. And that started coming in from one direction, and gradually all these other things started falling in place.
I notice you have a lot of sex and violence in the book, and yet it doesn't feel that way. You have managed to artfully, decorously deal with these aspects of life and without being as blatant as you will find. You work in the library, so probably you see passages in books that are very explicit. How does that make you feel when you read the very vivid language in today's writing?
I just don't think it's necessary. I mean, I want to write something interesting. I want to read something interesting, but that's not what interests me. I mean, it's the same way in life or in reading. I mean, subtle things to me are so much more interesting than, you know, there's just everything just barely laid out there. It's just boring to me. That's just the way I thought about it from the beginning. I'm just, there was just no way this book needed it. Or, I mean, I can't say any book that I might ever write. I don't know, because a particular character might have to, but that would only be to illustrate what kind of, you know, I just don't think it's necessary. It's more interesting to me to leave something to the imagination. Absolutely.
One last question, Louise Shivers. Now the book is out, or at least in the process of being distributed. I assume it's in the bookstores in Augusta. What's the reaction in your local community? Are you a celebrity?
It's been a very strange, slow reaction, as I suppose it usually is. Nobody believed it at first, and then when they would hear it, and they'd say, oh, this you know, pretty sweet woman has written a book, and they asked me, is it a cookbook? And and I just think, boy, you're going to be surprised. And they have been. And now that people are starting to really react, we had the autograph party there last Tuesday, and people were standing in line, and so many of them had already read it and said, everybody says the same thing. The minute I start reading it, I just can't put it down. They're very surprised.
And what about your husband and your family?
They've been pretty surprised, too.
Are they already?
My husband's been very surprised because he's just seen me around the house for the past 7 years working on this work. And
he thought you were doing a cookbook.
Yes, right, or knitting or what. But he loves it. He's like, this is so good. It's such a good story. So I've been trying to tell you that. But and my children are just ecstatic. They really think it's great now. But actually, my children helped me a lot of from the beginning. When they were in high school and studying creative writing, they would say, you've always said you wanted to do this. Why don't you try it sort of along with us? And they helped me get up the nerve to do it. And now I think it's pretty great. And they wanted me to write some more. But nobody knows how hard it is.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.